Movies as Mirrors is a conversation podcast about representation in movies, hosted by me, Benjamin Thevenin, Associate Professor of Media Arts at Brigham Young University. Now, in each episode, we feature a guest who selects a film that reflects a social issue that interests or affects them. On this episode, BYU Professor of Humanities George Hanley discusses the 2011 movie The Tree of Life, along with myself and guest host and media educator Camlin Giddens. In the conversation, we explore the Terrence Malick-directed film's representation of humans' relationship with the natural world and how eco-theology, that's an engagement with ecological issues that draws upon theological discourse, how it can be a productive way to introduce audiences to environmental issues. We also talk about the value of movies as environmental education for the public and discuss other films like the Darren Aronofsky-directed films The Fountain, Noah, and Mother, along with Paul Schrader's film, First Reformed. And we talk about the need for more nuanced cinematic representations of issues like climate change as a means of raising the public's awareness about these important issues. So take a listen. Hey, this is the Movies as Mirrors podcast. Each week on the podcast, we have on a guest. They choose a film that addresses an issue that interests or affects them, and then we talk about it. We hope that through our conversations, we can begin to understand one another a little bit better, address some pressing social issues, and make the world better in some small way. I'm Benjamin Thevenin, and this week I have co-hosting with me a past guest of the show, Camlin Giddens. Camlin, do you want to say hi?
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks.
Hey, Camlin, glad to have you back on the show. And then this week, our guest is George Hanley, scholar and author, fellow professor here at Brigham Young University. George, do you want to say hi?
Yes, I want to say hi.
Hi. Yeah, happy to be here.
George, thanks for coming on the show. For this week's conversation, George has chosen for us to talk about the film The Tree of Life. Now, The Tree of Life is a 2011 film written and directed by Terrence Malick, based in part on his own experiences as a boy in the 1950s. The primary story follows Jack, played by, as a boy, Hunter McCracken, and as an adult, Sean Penn, as he comes of age in a small suburb in Texas. Jack feels conflicted, torn between the goodness and grace taught to him by his mother, played by Jessica Chastain, and the self-interest and aggressiveness modeled to him by his father, played by Brad Pitt. Now, this particular personal story is set against a backdrop of the universal story, the creation of the cosmos, the creation of the earth, of life, death, what is to come after this life. And I'm excited to hear what George has to say about it.
There are two ways through life. The way of nature and the way of grace. You have to choose which one you'll follow.
We're alligators.
You'll be grown before that tree is tall.
It takes fierce will to get ahead in this world.
Come on, hit me. Hit me. Come on, son.
He's afraid of you. You expect things of him only an adult can accomplish.
I've just always wanted you to be strong, be your own man.
Father. Mother. Always you wrestle inside me. Always you will.
So, George, why don't we start by you sharing a little bit about yourself and then what your interest in this film in particular is.
Okay. Well, I'm a literary critic primarily. I'm not a film critic, but I have written a couple of essays about films over the years when they really grabbed my attention, and this was one of them. Probably mainly because I have been very interested in, as of last several years in my research, in the field of eco-theology, sort of looking at what environmental values and principles can be mined from or extracted from religious traditions, and how religion is thinking in the deepest way about the nature of the universe, the nature of the earth, and physical life, and where it fits in the cosmos. And as I was reading around this issue and reading novels and philosophy that pertain to the questions that interest me, I saw this film and I just thought, wow, nothing captured all of that together better than this film. And there's a little bit of a selfish attachment to it, and that is that I grew up in a family of three brothers, and my oldest brother took his life. And I didn't actually realize that this was a film that also related to suicide, because I don't know that it's ever really explicitly
explained
in the
loud.
Story. Yep. You just know that the telegraph arrives saying that the son is dead. But in Malick's life, right, this was his brother who did commit suicide. And it was my other brother, who also teaches literature, who had seen this, you know, around the same time I did, and he called me and he said, this is about a suicide. And I said, oh, I didn't register. So anyway, on a personal level, it kind of has a lot of importance, resonance for me, because it's sort of also very, very powerfully conveying sort of the lingering trauma of a suicide in a family's life, and a lot of the sort of theological wrestling that the character played by Sean Penn is going through to try to make sense of, you know, what happened and how it fits into the universe. So anyway, that's why I felt very particularly excited about it. And also by coincidence, I had just inquired of a colleague of mine who's a Kierkegaard specialist, and I had said, hey, I'm looking for, what did Kierkegaard ever say about Job? And came across some sermons by him that turn out to be used,
sampled in
by
the film,
this,
right?
In the scene in the church where the preacher is preaching, he's quoting Kierkegaard directly. So these things kind of are little mind-blowing moments where I was like, okay, I have to dig into this much more than
philosophy this. And eco-theology and literature and your own personal experience all connect in this way. There's something happening.
Yeah,
here.
It's like I can't look away. I gotta keep going. So
I'm curious, George, your interest in ecological issues, was there a particular experience, like a personal experience that you had that kind of sparked that interest, that fed to your, your research in this area in particular, for example?
Yeah, I taught at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff before coming to BYU, and they had a big environmental focus on their campus, and they actually had a workshop that was really kind of roll up your sleeves kind of opportunity to rethink your discipline in light of the principles of sustainability. They were kind of challenging you to revamp a syllabus of a course that you were teaching to be more aware of environmental issues. And I was a little skeptical at first. They were offering money, so I took the money. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to get money to take a workshop? I'm a poor professor. And it was kind of life-changing, career-changing, certainly. I mean, I suddenly had a completely different awareness of the importance of the humanities in relationship to the environment. And this was in 1996. So the what are now known as the environmental humanities didn't even have that name at that point. It was barely known as eco-criticism at the time. And so I started researching that pretty heavily from that point forward. But I also, I mean, sort of again on a side note, I was writing about my family history in a memoir that I wrote called Home Waters. And I was wanting to write a book about the history of the local watershed here in Utah Valley, the Provo River watershed. And it's a longer story, but at the end of writing that, I kind of came to a realization about the connection between my love of nature and the loss of my brother, and that they were deeply interconnected, and I hadn't realized that previously. So I guess the short answer is I was not trained as an environmental writer or thinker or philosopher, but I retrained myself after the late 90s, and and then sort of made that personal connection that the film helped to connect for me as well. Just the awareness of the beauty and wonder and sort of awe of the natural world is, I think, related to our openness to suffering, and often a function of our suffering that is important to recognize. And when we're closed off to the natural world, we're also probably closed off to our own sorrows in some ways.
That's great.
Mm. I was going to ask George, especially for maybe those viewers that this may be new to, how this film handles nature and theology different or unique compared to others that might touch on this topic?
Yeah. Well, in film, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that there are that many films that deal with theology and the natural world very much at all. But I would say there's a lot written about that, more or less, at least from the Christian point of view, which this film is invested in. It's usually along the lines of, you know, the Pope Francis's encyclical, or you know, there's evangelical environmentalists and Baptist environmentalists who are kind of arguing for a stewardship model. And mm-hmm. so it's sort of a rereading of Genesis in order to argue that human beings are not here to exploit the world and the natural resources of the planet, but are our charge from God is to sort of tend the garden and preserve it for future generations. So it's a softer version of dominionism, right? It's kind of revisionism of the more exploitative models that have come out of Christian thought. And that, of course, is not what this film is not even touching on that. And that actually was kind of what fascinated me, is that it was very clearly a film that was in love with the world, right? In love with the natural world, and that there was a deep spiritual connection between the natural world and human meaning. And you know, the tree of life being sort of the trees of Waco, right? It was really fascinating to me that paradise was kind of readily available if you had the eyes to see it, and that there was a sort of artistic charge to, you know, really stop being lazy in the way that we view the world and understand it for its glory. And this is put in very theological terms in the film. It's God's glory, right, that is sort of available, certainly to the mother figure in the film. But again, it's deeply connected to suffering, right? I mean, her openness to the world, which is very beautifully articulated at the very beginning of the film, where she's talking about the way of nature and the way of grace, and then she says, you know, the way of grace is absorbing, I think the phrase she uses, insults and injuries. And then toward the end of that, she says, you know, as she's formed spiritually as a young girl, she says, I was willing to accept whatever would come.
Grace doesn't try to please itself. Accepts being slighted, forgotten, disliked. Accepts insults and injuries. Nature only wants to please itself.
Bless, O Lord, this food.
Get others to please it too.
Loving and faithful service.
Likes to lord it over them.
Bless these boys.
To have its own way. It finds reasons to be unhappy when all the world is shining around it. And love is smiling through all things. They taught us that no one who loves the way of grace ever comes to a bad end. I will be true to you. whatever comes.
And then the next scene is the arrival of the message that her son has died. You know, so you've jumped from her childhood up into the future. And so she, her willingness to be open to the glory of the natural world that's so beautifully demonstrated in those early scenes where she's kind of touching the flowers and the cows and everything and looking out the window, is also her vulnerability, right? Her ability to feel and accept sorrow and really suffer through it, right? I mean, she doesn't, even though her friend tries to sort of give her a superficial version of like it'll be better in the end or he's in a better place or something, I can't remember what she said, her friend says to her, but she's like, no, that's not easy, that's not comforting to her.
I like that you're explaining the nature and grace theme that the film opens with, and I'm wondering if you like agree with that, with those two ways. Do you agree with that statement that there are two ways, nature and grace?
It's a little dualistic, but I think it's a very provocative framing for the film. It certainly works in terms of how the film plays out. The father, you know, there's a pivotal line. He says, "I wanted to be loved because I was great, a big man. I'm nothing. Look at the glory around us, trees and birds. I lived in shame. I dishonored it all and didn't notice the glory. I'm a foolish man." I mean, that's the most beautiful, moving moment in the whole film, you know, where there's this sort of Christian acceptance of one's foolishness, and that is a kind of redemption, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what I found very significant was that his self-made manhood and his sort of, you know, he teaches his boys to be aggressive and you can't be too good in this world and you know the world is won by trickery, you know, that scene where he's driving with the boys after the Sunday sermon and he's pointing out all the big houses and everything and he's sort of telling them that your mother is a little too naive, she doesn't understand this and you really have to understand this. The problem is that sort of position has created a kind of protection in him that's, he's trying to be invulnerable, or he's trying to control his own destiny. He's not open. And that, in the end, means he's missed all the glory, mm-hmm. you know. And it's natural glory. You know, as he says, the birds and the trees, that's very intentionally, for me, sort of an eco-theological opening, that if you can't see wonder in the natural world, why would you even care to take care of it? I mean, so even though the film isn't really touching on heavy-handed stewardship themes, I think it has really profound implications that we're kind of indifferent to nature because we can't deal with our own suffering. And there is, by the way, that wonderful, disturbing scene where they're spraying DDT when they're kids.
Oh, yeah, and the kids are running through it.
Fog, you know, you're like, whoa, man.
George, do you feel like there's a benefit from this approach that the film is taking that, in contrast to an activist film, right? An Inconvenient Truth or something that is more explicit about its agenda. Is there a benefit from this approach that is not only approaching kind of through spirituality, but then also is doing it implicitly, you know, through these kind of the beautiful photography of this natural environment that surrounds the family and through the creation sequence, you know?
Yeah.
What's the benefit of this particular approach, do you feel like?
Well, first of all, I think one of the reasons why eco-theology was born as a field was because there was an awareness that religion perhaps had been part of the problem, you know, that we had, at least from Western religion, adopted modes of looking at the world as instrumental, as a way station between, you know, destinies, and that this isn't really our ultimate home, and the body is not actually our ultimate identity even. We're not, you know, primarily embodied beings, but we're spiritual. And so there was a sense that Western religion, Christianity in particular, had sort of been part of the problem. But eco-theologians tried to say, well then if we're part of the problem, let's try to be part of the solution. And a lot of environmental film doesn't take advantage of that opportunity, because a lot of people are motivated by religion in some very fundamental ways. It's a very effective way to shape people's moral lenses, and it also turns out to be the source of a lot of resistance to something like climate change right now. Like, yeah. A lot of Christian conservatives are having a very hard time wrapping their minds around climate change. And so, you know, if you're an environmentalist, which I consider myself to be, but you can sort of say, well, then you know, these, we just need to move around that worldview or get rid of it or persuade people to drop it because it's not working. And that's actually not a very effective strategy. Mm-hmm. I've had one fellow literary critic say to me, why don't we just get rid of religion? And I said, well, I think you'd have better luck getting rid of climate change than getting rid of religion. So I think actually it's very advantageous to go right at a kind of theological way of thinking about it. Obviously, that's not relevant to everybody, but for people for whom that's relevant, that's it's potentially really important strategy. And again, what's different, I mean, this is a very subtle difference, but I think it's a very important one. This isn't a feel-good film about how easily manageable the world is. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems with climate change is that it exposes how difficult it is to be in the driver's seat. I mean, it exposes the fact that we are in the driver's seat, and then mm-hmm. it says, and... there are so many contingencies here. It's not really, we can't guarantee outcomes here. This is, mm-hmm. we sort of have to wager certain things and figure out what the best case outcome might be or the best case scenario might be. But but a lot of people who are in a skeptical mode say, well, until you can guarantee that we're going to get, you know, this many degrees by this decade, by these means exactly, then I'm not in. You know, I'm call me a skeptic, and in fact I'm going to do nothing. And of course, while we do nothing, things get worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. So I actually think this film is very helpful because it sort of confronts the problem of human suffering and the inequalities or injustices of life that we can't quite make full sense of, and it helps us to find a hopeful way to confront that kind of a reality without oversimplifying the story, which I think is a bit of a risk and a bit of a danger when we, either from like an economic and political point of view, we say, well, if we just do X, Y, and Z, everything's going to work out. Or from a religious point of view, we say, well, if you just do X, Y, and Z, everything's going to work out because yeah. it's all in God's hands. And I think both scenarios paint a picture that's a little too simplistic, and we have to really confront the unease that we feel about uncertainty, right? It's that's what I just love about the film, is because it, you know, it makes accident and chaos kind of part of the, it understands wisely that that's part of the creation mm-hmm. from an evolutionary point of view. Mm-hmm. That's what makes life possible. And if that's what makes life possible, it also means that if we're going to try to be serious about preserving life, we can't pretend that we get to manage the life systems in a sealed way that doesn't have to account for unpredictability. That's just hard work.
So do you feel like, I mean, because this is a film that is interested in that, acknowledging that loss or the uncertainty, engaging with suffering and finding some kind of transcendence, I feel like, mm-hmm. in that suffering. If there is an ecological message to be learned from this, I'm thinking about the ending of the film and that kind of beatific afterlife that's represented, in which there's a reconciliation between the different members of the family, mm-hmm. shot here on the salt flats, right?
Yeah.
And so it's in this kind of like unique, beautiful natural landscape. What does this teach us about addressing ecological issues in our own world, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm pulling more out of it than it in, you know, that Malik may not have been thinking.
We're not interested in authorial intention
yeah,
here.
Good. I mean, I just think, again, I would go back to the father's epiphany, you know, that we mistreat things, I think, that we're indifferent to, right? Or mm-hmm. certainly things that are not even visible to us, right? And so, if the physical world is we're indifferent to it, or it's not really visible to us in a really profound sense, then we're likely to mistreat it. And if we feel threatened by it, even more, right? Mm-hmm. If we feel like, and that's actually, there's a lot of hatred of nature that drives mm-hmm. a lot of our destruction of it. It's like we mm-hmm. as a species are sick and tired of our defeats at the hand mm-hmm. of nature, so we're going to wrestle her to the ground and make her do what we want her to do, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a real violent intolerance that's at the heart of that, that is, again, a sort of fear of our own suffering, right? Mm-hmm. Because suffering, I mean, when I'm talking about suffering, I'm talking about physical. I mean, there's existential and emotional components to that, but I mean, I'm talking about dying.
Yeah.
And that we're biological and that we can't control things, right? The father can't control his own death, let alone his own career.
Or the right? grass in his yard, right?
The grass struggles in his yard, with that. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And his boys, mm-hmm. right? And so there's that wonderful scene where the father's away and the mother just, you know, the kids are just kind of... And I actually think there's a bit of a dialectical thing going on in the film where Malick is not... He's not castigating the father wholly and completely. I mean, I think he sort of seems to be suggesting that, you know, these two components have to sort of work
come
together.
Into balance.
Yeah,
in some way,
come
yeah.
into balance.
Yeah.
And I think you get a sense, at least in the marriage, that there's a little bit of that. I mean, I found them very disturbing. You know, the scene in the kitchen where he's just strong-arming her and wrestling her, basically, and control. You can see it's just all about control, and he does this with his boys too. Mm-hmm. So there's a. I think that is destructive of nature. I think that is the heart of destroying nature, is sort of this intolerance for the fact of sort of agency abounding and life emerging everywhere and not being in our direct control. And not being able to tolerate that is an incredibly narcissistic, egotistical kind of impulse that has to be overcome. And I think he does sort of, you know, we don't really get a clear sense later on. You know, you know that he's talking to the figure of Sean Penn, presumably is an older man. Mm-hmm. You know that he's suffering. I don't know, I'm thinking of the scene. I think there's a scene where he's talking to what sounds like his father.
Yeah. On the phone.
Yeah, on the phone. And so you get a sense that, okay, they still have a relationship, mm-hmm. and this is decades later, and this is still painful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, knowing what he comes to realize about himself earlier, of course, the timeline on these things is kind of foggy, but knowing that he has come to this awareness of his own foolishness gives you a little hope.
Yeah.
And I think that, anyway, I just sort of feel like there's value in the sort of prostrate foolishness that the father comes to, that maybe as a civilization we need a little of too.
But we could exercise some humility in addressing some of these issues.
Yeah.
So after viewing this film, are you looking forward to any similar films in this strain? What do you think we still need, even though we have The Tree of Life, what is still needed as far as storytelling goes on this topic?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, well, I'm always game for any more films by him, by Malick.
He has one coming out this year.
I understand that, so I'm pretty excited. I mean, his last one was not very successful, but I'm anticipating, always willing to take a look. But I suppose tying the knots that I'm trying to tie here would be fun to see in a film where there's sort of... this awareness of the tragic nature of the natural world and our relationship to it, and that we are tragic beings, but there's redemption and there's hope possible, but that redemption and hope isn't offered as sort of overriding all of that tragedy, but actually looking at it straight on. That would be kind of fun. I mean, we were talking about the film Noah by Darren Aronofsky. I think that film tries to do some of that kind of work, but I just would love more of that. I think films that take theology really seriously are very exciting. I mean, I'm a big fan of First Reformed by Paul Schrader, and I think he certainly takes theology very seriously in that film. And
is addressing environmental issues as well.
And is addressing directly the question of climate change in some really provocative ways. So I think more of that kind of stuff is really... really valuable. I mean, I suppose I could imagine a kind of feel-good Hollywood film that stars Matt Damon as an evangelical evangelical preacher in the South who kind of has this awakening about climate change. And, you know,
I mean, it would reach an audience that would benefit. Right?
Yeah, no, so. I mean, I would be a fan of that, even if it was like more superficial theology that was the result of it, because I think it still could produce some good. I mean, I teach this film regularly to religious students, and even though they instinctively recognize this film as spiritually saturated with serious thought about Christianity and the meaning of life in a metaphysical way, they also really struggle to understand it. And even once they start to understand it, they struggle to decide whether or not they like it, mm-hmm. because it's tough. Mm-hmm. It's tough. It's not easy theology. And I tend to favor the kind of the tougher kind, because I think that's where we have to get to. But I maybe I'm a milk before meat kind of guy. Like, I can recognize the value. In some ways, I feel like we haven't had the milk at all. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of films that are really diving into the heavy theology, but we haven't had the kind of more popularized version. Instead, what we get, and I'm not saying this to be critical, but Avatar is a film that is very serious about its indigenous theology, mm-hmm. and it's very interesting and provocative. It's got its problems. It's got its kind of colonialist overlay that's very problematic, et cetera, et cetera. But it was taking a theology or a theological perspective quite seriously. The only problem is, and I don't say this I'd say this for political, pragmatic purposes more than anything, I just think we need a really serious and aggressive attempt by a lot of filmmakers to tackle Christian eco-theology head on so that it's popularized. Because yeah. I think there's limits to how far you can go with a non-Western perspective in persuading Westerners.
When I see the nature versus grace kind of proposal that's put into this film, I always thought grace was nature and nature was grace. And I think the ego is what, like, the nature character is meant to be. I think it's ego, which is something entirely different. And so I feel like this film and this conversation, yes, is needed in Christian circles, but could also, if put in the right way, could transcend Christianity, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And, like, really connect with relationship.
Well, do you have a sense that that's what this film does? That it transcends, even though it's very Christian, that it transcends its Christianity?
I think in certain circles it can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it can.
I mean, I saw this film when it opened and I was getting my PhD in Boulder, Colorado. And I remember actually in particular seeing the film with my wife, and she said the audience was a perfect sampling of the Boulder community because it was aging hippies and like hipsters with funky glasses.
Yeah.
And there was an overwhelmingly positive response in the theater to the film from, I would imagine, like a largely secular crowd that would see, I think, the use of theological perspective to address ecological issues as valuable.
Yeah, so this is what I'm getting at. I think, I mean, I would argue it does succeed in transcending it, but that's because whenever you take any theological perspective seriously enough and you treat it deeply enough, it does transcend. I mean, it speaks to across cultures, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so you could do the same thing with Buddhism, right? And you could say we need we have an environmental ethic that's emerged, at least in the context of the United States, from writings like Gary Snyder's, which is heavily influenced by Buddhism. And you can say, and even the Christian Wendell Berry was very influenced by that too. Yeah. So, I mean, there's whenever you take theology seriously, it does tend to be more accessible. When you make it into a sectarian battle and it's about identity, that loses people very quickly. But on the other hand, like I was saying earlier, I mean, if there was a film made for and by evangelicals to speak to evangelicals about creation care, man, I would be like totally two thumbs up and supportive of that effort, even if it wasn't something that transcended the tradition, just because I think it would be valuable for that audience. I mean, I'm a firm believer that the climate change battle cannot be won by just convincing everybody that there's one worldview that's the right one and everything else is wrong. And too often that's how we go into the struggle. It's about, like, you know, convincing someone else that their worldview is wrong. And all that does is cause people to dig their heels in of skepticism and denial and say, I don't want anything to do with this. I mean, these people are telling me I don't have any legitimacy. I'm not mm-hmm. visible to them. I don't have any anything to offer. And when you look at a film like First Reformed or this film and you say, well, Christianity has a lot to offer here if it's treated with the kind of seriousness that it deserves. But unfortunately, it often gets kind of flattened in the cultural discourse, and it's not very interesting. And it's usually because it's more of a straw man figure that's mm-hmm. representing that perspective than anything else. And so I think that's what I would hope mm-hmm. is that... and I don't just say that. I'm a religious person myself. I don't say that because I want to see more films that have religious themes, although that's true. I like them. Mm-hmm. But it's much more a serious argument about what's going to work in terms of moving people.
There's a pragmatism yeah. to this approach. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that was, you know, I don't think that was, even though it doesn't matter what Malick intended, I don't think that's what was on his mind. It was very clearly what was on Aronofsky's mind when he made Noah. He wanted that story to move people who cared about that story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was,
nice.
It was a very interesting attempt.
Until we get more of those films, the recommendations that you, aside from Tree of Life, would give are Noah, you mentioned Avatar.
First Reformed.
Yeah. Okay, anything else that comes to mind?
Well, Aronofsky, I think, is doing something interesting with The Fountain, with Noah, and with Mother. These are all films that are interested in eco-theology, that are approaching both spirituality and ecology in this kind of interesting, I don't know, intersection.
Yeah, I agree. One film I quite like, which isn't actually theological, Downsizing, which has Matt Damon as mm-hmm. the lead figure, is actually, when I saw the trailer for it, I thought it was just going to be a comedy and kind of a goofy movie, and it was actually really morally quite interesting. Mm-hmm. So I think any film that sort of is willing to critique environmentalism at the same time that it's willing to advance a kind of idea, that's maybe where I would say Avatar fails, is that it's not so interested in self-critique. But like First Reformed is profoundly self-critical at the same time that it's trying to find a way toward hope, right?
Yeah.
But recognizing that the protagonist of the story is completely hypocritical and self-destructive, even as he's concerned about the environment, you mm-hmm. know? I think that's good stuff. That's what we need. Princess Mononoke.
That's probably the film, right?
I think that's, yeah. I think, and that also is deeply invested in Shintoism and sort of Japanese cultural and theological language that speaks, that sort of its animism and so on. I think it's really, really morally complex in a very productive way. I think that's a fabulous film.
I think, yeah. I mean, a characteristic that I'm noticing across all these films is that it may nod to a type of duality, that there's this nature, culture, or human nature divide or something like that, but that all of them seek to complicate that and really be self-critical, like you've mentioned, but also kind of dig into the details. I think it's really easy to tell a story in which heroic nature triumphs over like destructive humanity or something like that.
Right.
But each of these, either because they're informed by trying to create a pragmatic approach, or they're more interested in digging deeper into the issue, that they complicate things.
And I usually go right to like who the antagonist is, and if I can see any kind of moral complexity in the antagonist, then I'm hooked in. But like, there's zero in Avatar, right? The guy mm-hmm. who's the military guy is just a cartoon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, people who are willing to be destructive of the environment in a more complex story, I don't know if the reference I can quickly give in Noah is Tubal Cain, who's really the antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
He says something very disturbing while he's sitting in the belly of the ship and he's eating a armadillo raw, and Noah's son is freaking out, saying, "What are you doing? You can't touch those creatures. Those are God's creatures." And he says, Your father has filled this ship full of animals while children are dying.
Mm-hmm.
how is that moral? You know, like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And even though he's like grotesquely dominionist in his attitude, he's also raised a really disturbing question that the film is putting front and center. Like, mm-hmm. this is massive genocide next to the preservation of nature. What in the world is going on in this story?
Yeah.
This is not a feel-good story where you make Fisher-Price toys and march the elephants into the ship while everyone dies. That's the part you don't tell your kids when they're playing with, with the little animals.
Right.
Anyway.
They need little plastic figures of all the dying, drowning people.
Right, right.
That'll complete the story for
so,
the children.
So, yeah, I'm always interested in that kind of complexity. I think that, that shows kind of moral sophistication, right, in a film or in a novel, you know.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a great conversation, George. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your perspectives on the Tree of Life and just these important issues. I think as scholars, as media creators, as audiences, as citizens, like, hopefully we're all increasingly recognizing just the necessity for us to engage with just rethinking our relationship with the natural world and acting in ways, whether it be through storytelling or filmmaking, or whether through our activist efforts, or just everyday kind of consumption, acting in ways that are more responsible, and I think that this this conversation could be a part of that.
No, I hope so. Yeah, thank you.
Before we end the episode, we do want to address our audience question from a couple of episodes ago. We visited with Chantel Squires, and she and Kimball and I talked about the film On the Basis of Sex. And a question that we asked our audience after hearing the story of Ruth Bader Ginsburg was, who are the women whose stories we've not yet seen on screen? And we had a few people write in. Melody Chow wrote she wants more movies about trans Asian women. We had Michelle Meyer say there are hundreds of women on both sides who fought in the Civil War. Bon Josie wrote, I want to see Native American women on screen. I was curious, George and Camelin, if you guys had any thoughts about the communities of women or particular women within history or contemporarily that that deserve to have their stories told on screen, that we could benefit from hearing their perspectives and hearing their voices. Camelin, do you have any thoughts?
Oh, yeah. I've got a list. I'm just wondering how many should I see. I'll just spout off the ones that came to mind. But on this topic, interestingly enough, I recently heard, I was part of a conference that was environmentally focused and talking a lot about food, and there was an Indian woman who said that our relationship to nature very closely mirrors our relationship to women. And I really wanted to hear more about, one, her experience, the things that she's learning, and the women in these communities. And I don't have a name, because these are like women who are working, creating their own businesses in these communities, but have this understanding about nature and women. So I would like stories about that.
Eco-feminist stories.
Exactly. And maybe we don't know the names of these women, but there are communities and I want to know about them. So that's
great.
One.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would second that, actually. You know, I live here in Provo, which, you know, it's probably no secret to anyone, is a predominantly Latter-day Saint community in terms of demographics. And one of the things that I've experienced in working on environmental issues is that there are a lot of Latter-day Saint women who are doing enormous amounts of work and no one's paying any attention to them. No one knows their names. Nobody sees them in the newspaper. You know, what you get are sort of quips from congressmen and state legislators and county commissioners who are fighting these battles in Utah over the environment, and you don't see that there are numerous women, both Latter-day Saint and of other traditions, who are, and men too, but people who are sort of the quiet warriors. I think the sort of the quiet warrior type is what I'm most interested in, because I think they have faced obstacles that are pretty strong, and yet they've demonstrated a kind of persistence over. I mean, I know a few women who are in their late 80s who like helped preserve the Provo River and helped preserve Rock Canyon and done stuff that we don't even realize was vulnerable at any point.
That's great. George, Cameron, thanks for your responses. I'm looking forward to hearing some more audience responses to this question as well. We're going to wrap up our episode. I just want to thank you both again for coming on today. And thanking Alexis Romero Walker for running our social media. If you do have questions for us, if you have responses to our audience questions, we'd invite you to jump on Instagram and Facebook and let us know how you're feeling. And then thanks to Aiden Bay for our musical intro. We'll see you next week.
Movies as Mirrors is a conversation podcast about representation in movies, hosted by me, Benjamin Thevenin, Associate Professor of Media Arts at Brigham Young University. Now, in each episode, we feature a guest who selects a film that reflects a social issue that interests or affects them. On this episode, BYU Professor of Humanities George Hanley discusses the 2011 movie The Tree of Life, along with myself and guest host and media educator Camlin Giddens. In the conversation, we explore the Terrence Malick-directed film's representation of humans' relationship with the natural world and how eco-theology, that's an engagement with ecological issues that draws upon theological discourse, how it can be a productive way to introduce audiences to environmental issues. We also talk about the value of movies as environmental education for the public and discuss other films like the Darren Aronofsky-directed films The Fountain, Noah, and Mother, along with Paul Schrader's film First Reformed. And we talk about the need for more nuanced cinematic representations of issues like climate change as a means of raising the public's awareness about these important issues. So take a listen.